numbskulls, I'm broadcasting.
This is Stuart Venner. I tell it as I see it, and I see it as it is.
It was interesting, but it was also stupid.
The opinions expressed by Stuart Venner are not necessarily the views of this station and should be regarded as rantings of a very sick, perverted mind.
Folks, this is Stuart Venner. We've got a great show in store for you this week. We're going to be speaking to Kirk Schneider. He's going to tell us how extremism is killing America. We're also talking to Dr. Mel Schwartz. He's a marriage and family counselor and is going to discuss how silence can be deadly in a relationship. Dr. Dina, the inspiration for the television show Weeds, is going to tell us how medical marijuana is a good thing. Jason, our producer, is interviewing Dom Herrera, a comedian, a very, very funny guy. We're talking to Charles Faddis. He's a CIA agent, a former one, and is going to tell us things that are amazing. And finally, we have our interview each week with Fred Claridge, the stock market moron. Stay tuned. I'm sure you're going to love the show.
There was an old farmer who lived on a rock. He sat in the meadow just shaking his fist at some boys who were down by the creek. Their feet in the water, their hands on their marbles and playthings, and at 4:30 there came a young lady. She looked like a pretty young creature. She sat on the grass. She pulled up her dress and she showed them her ruffles and laces and white fluffy duck. She said she was learning a new way to bring up her children so they would not spit, while the boys in the barnyard were shoveling refuse and litter from yesterday.
I have Dr. Kirk J. Schneider on the line. He's a PhD, a licensed psychologist, a leading spokesman for contemporary humanistic psychology. And Dr. Schneider is the past editor of the Journal of Humanistic Psychology and vice president of the Existential Humanistic Institute. That's a mouthful.
It is.
And he's got right. Quite an impressive resume. Dr. Schneider, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you very much, Stuart. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. And I think what we're going to speak about today is how extremism is really killing America.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you agree?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, not just America. I think it's been destructive for millennia, and really that's the focus of my book, The Polarized Mind, why it's killing us and what we can do about it. And basically I focus in on what I call humanity's hidden plague, which we seem to repeat over and over again, and that is we seem to foment groups and individuals who fixate on one point of view to the utter exclusion of competing points of view.
Well, I agree with you there. I mean,
multicultural.
We're dealing with a country today where political correctness has taken over common sense, I think.
Well, I think I don't think this is a left or right issue. I really think it's an issue of extremism in that polarized sense. Across the board. I mean, we see it in elements of what I might call a dogmatic technocratic atheist position. We see it in elements of a dogmatic fundamentalist religious position. We see it in politics.
Yeah, I mean, in the name of religion, humanity has done the worst atrocities to one another, and all the religions have done this.
Well, yes, that's for sure. But I would also say in the name of dogmatic ideologies and how people can get so fanatical about both secular and religious ideology throughout history has been very destructive.
Anytime you criticize our president, you're a racist.
Well, I mean, I suppose there are people who, react that way. But again, that seems to me a very rigid position, absolutist position. It's so vital that we have an ability to discuss things and to be able to pause a little bit and not react in such a knee-jerk way, so that we can get to the deeper understanding of problems in our society.
Well, I mean, the problems with, I think the biggest problem we face in the world today, is certainly in this country, is the Muslim extremism.
Well, again, it's certainly a major issue. If you're talking about terrorism, or...
Well, sure, these people want to destroy our way of life, they want to destroy us, and they want to kill us, basically, and to whitewash it, I think, is ridiculous.
Well, I think, again, there are certainly elements that are very threatening, as you say. But I wouldn't want to, you know, dub a whole movement as demonic, if you will. I mean,
no, but certainly all Muslims are not terrorists. But I think pretty much all terrorists are Muslim. And we don't want to admit that.
Well, I wouldn't say that all terrorists are Muslim, and we've certainly seen some
maybe
terrorists
99%.
In our own country. The 1995, you know,
95%.
Bombing.
95%, that's
still
a
federal
lot.
What's that?
That's a lot.
What's a lot?
I mean, it's a huge number of the terrorism that we have around the whole world is fostered and is created by people seeking Islam and trying to dominate everyone else, and if you're not a believer in Islam, they want to kill you.
Again, I think we've seen this kind of extremism in secular societies as well. We saw it in totalitarian China, totalitarian Russia.
That is true.
And these are atheistic movements.
But I don't feel in fear personally in America of the Chinese coming and wanting to kill me.
No, I agree with that. We certainly have some
challenging issues. I mean, when I get on an airplane, I'm not nervous if there's an Oriental person boarding the plane, but if you got somebody with the turban on his head and looks like a terrorist, I look at them and it makes me very nervous.
Well, I think we have to be very careful about profiling, but I mean, I understand your feelings, but the issue is we don't want to, you know, feed the flames of hatred and polarization.
Well, no, but I think profiling is realistic. I mean, today if somebody is robbed, and if robbed by a black young male, the police in many places can't even say that it's a black young male. They have to say it's a young man. So how are they going to find the person? I mean, profiling is realistic to a certain extent, don't you think?
I think your key words there are to a certain extent, because they may help accurately identify someone. But as soon as we start down that road of just stereotyping simple black and white perceptions, then we're feeding the flames of polarization. But I think we need to get to the deeper issue here, is why do people become so fixated on one point of view to the exclusion of others?
Uh-huh.
That's really what my book is about. And then the second half is, what can we do to address it? And I think it has a lot to do with somebody being really thrown out of their comfort zone and lost and, in a sense, groundless and feeling helpless. And so it's easy at that point to then be attracted to a mass movement.
If I'm flying on an airplane, I'd much rather be felt up than blown up. I'm serious.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's a lot of danger out there. And I think you have to be realistic. And if you don't profile,
yes,
how are you going to get the right person? I mean, LL Airlines, as far as I know, has never had a hijacking or has ever had a terrorist attack. And they profile everybody.
Right.
And it works.
It seems to be successful, yeah. Although they've certainly had a lot of problems with, as you know, with bombings in their society.
Of course they have.
So.
But, you know, they're humanistic. If they weren't, they would have gone out and wiped out Palestine and any of these countries. I mean, they could do it. That would end the bombings instantaneously, but they're not trying to seek to kill innocent people. Unlike the Hamas and the Palestinians.
They're certainly, as you say, more humanistic than what they could have been in reaction. And they're in a position of greater power, so it's a very complex situation there.
We can't solve that in 5 minutes. I know that.
No.
Dr. Schneider, can you tell us about your book that you've written? Because I want everybody to have a chance to read that.
Thank you. Well, again, it's about the history of the polarized mind. It's about how leaders, the first half is about how leaders and their cultures in power centers throughout the world, like ancient Greece, and Rome, actually begins with the Gilgamesh myth, so Babylonian myth. It goes very deep into our history and takes us right up through, you know, Christian Empire and Imperial France and England and Russia.
Well, I very
of course,
much
Nazi
would like
Germany,
to read that myself.
China,
sounds,
Japan.
Sounds
what's
really
it?
Interesting. What is? Could you tell us the name of the book?
It's called The Polarized Mind.
The polarized
why it's killing
mind.
Us and what
and
we can
where
do about
it. Be, Amazon, I imagine, Barnes and Noble.
Yes, it's available at all those outlets.
All right, everybody out there, it's The Polarized Mind by Dr. Kirk J. Schneider. And I think it's a fascinating thing. We'll go for Amazon, Barnes & Noble, pretty much everywhere. And it sounds like the kind of book, it's one I certainly want to read. Dr. Schneider, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Things you don't say to your wife. I planned a hunting trip next week on your birthday. I didn't ask you, but I knew it'd be okay. Go make some dinner while I watch this fishing show. I taped it over our old wedding video. If you're a man who've done that, a long and happy life. Here's all the things you'll do to you leave. Solo! Okay. Your cooking is okay, but not like mother makes. The diamond in the ring I bought you is a fake. Your eyes look puffy, dear. Are you feeling ill? Happy anniversary, I bought you a treadmill. You're a man who wants to live a long and happy life, that too. These are the things you don't say to me. You're a man who doesn't want to get killed with a knife. These are the things you don't say to me.
Welcome back to the show. I am delighted to have Mel Schwartz on the line. Mel is a psychotherapist, a marriage counselor, an executive coach, and a seminar leader. But what we're talking about is a book that he's written called The Art of Intimacy. And we're going to talk about how important it is to have good communication with your spouse. Welcome to the show, Mel.
Thank you, Stuart. Pleasure to be with you.
Oh, it's my pleasure to have you. Could you tell us a little bit about what you do?
Well, other than repeat what you just said, Stuart, I try to help people navigate life. It's a very general way of speaking about my work as a marriage counselor and as a psychotherapist. Sometimes couples come to me who have just recently gotten engaged.
Yes.
And they're deeply in love, and they're having no problems. Why are they coming to see me? They're coming to see me because they realize that the chances are that they're going to fall out of love.
Well, maybe they're not in love, but in lust. There's
50-50 chances they're going to get divorced. And the greater problem is the majority of intact marriages, aren't happy. So as an institution, committed relationship and marriage has an incredible, staggering rate of failure. And the problem is that we go into this most important engagement in our lives blind as to what we need to do to succeed. So well, I try to take the stigma out of it and say, listen.
I myself have been married 3 times.
Well, there you go.
But I have a system. You see, I keep marrying younger women.
And is that working for you, Stuart?
Well, right now it is. And I think I've got to stop now because right now there's over 25 years difference. And if I keep doing this, I'll have to go through puberty again. And I don't want to do that.
And you know, one of the challenges with marrying younger women is that if you're successful in your relationship, over time, they're going to get older.
Well, that's true. See, that's what happened with the last one.
So, you know, for all the women listening in right now, you better duck, Stuart.
That's exactly right. I like that. Now, you've written a book also about the pleasure of passion.
Well, that's the same book.
Same book,
it's called The Art of Intimacy, The Pleasure of Passion.
Does a big schwanz help?
Excuse me?
Does a big schlong help?
Well, temporarily, at
okay,
least.
I guess.
You know, why do I speak about the pleasure of passion? Because, again, there's a myth that long-term relationships, passion dies. Well, it doesn't have to, but it's like a fire in the fireplace. If you don't stoke the fire and keep it going, it will go. Same thing with passion. You know, we fall asleep in our relationships once we secure the relationship. You've got a commitment, you've got a marriage license, and the passion goes because we're no longer working on the relationship.
Well, that makes a heck of a lot of sense. And I know you talk about the importance of communication and how silence can build walls.
Yeah, I just wrote an article called Silence, A Relationship Killer. And I have a blog on my website. It's called ashiftofmind.com. And I also post it to Psychology Today. I got 110,000 reads on this in 3 days.
Oh, my gosh.
Which tells me how loudly this is an issue. So silence can be very manipulative, and silence can be controlling.
My first wife used to give me the silent treatment, and I hated it.
That's right. But you know, think about it. When you're silent, when you're not sharing certain information with your partner, you're controlling them. You're controlling their reaction, perhaps because you don't want to hear it or deal with it. You're controlling the flow of information. Silence will destroy your relationship.
I think you're absolutely right there. I mean, you have to keep open communication. That's very important. And tell us your book. Where can people get it?
Well, you can get my book on Amazon. You can get it by coming to my website, which is my name, melschwartz.com. And I also offer a free ebook version.
Well,
so if you want the hardcover, you can write to me and order it or buy it on Amazon. Or you send me an email to mel@melschwartz.com with your email address, and I will send you a free ebook version of the book.
Well, I think you really are very intelligent. And I was kidding you a little bit, but you're absolutely right. And you're right when you tell the women, avoid somebody like me.
Well, Stuart, I have an opening at 2 in the afternoon on Tuesdays if you want to give me a call. We'll go to work on it.
Well, I'm going to keep this one. This one's pretty good.
Okay.
Now, you tell us a little bit. You have a practice. Where is your practice? If people
I'm
are
located
in
Westport, Connecticut. That said, for your listeners who are quite a distance away, I work with people all over the world, by phone, by Skype, and by FaceTime.
Well, that is wonderful. Do you want to give us your phone number, how people could contact
certainly.
You?
Certainly. My phone number is area code 203-227-5010, or you can write to me once again at mel@melschwartz.com.
Mel, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show.
Derp, 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 derp. Maya he, Maya who, Maya ha, Maya ha ha. Derp, 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 derp. Maya he, Maya who, Maya ha, Maya ha ha, Maya he.
show, I have a real great and interesting guest on the line. This is Dr. Dina. Dr. Dina was the inspiration for the show Weeds, and we're going to talk about the legalization and the importance of medical marijuana. Good morning, Dr. Dina.
Good morning. How are you today?
I am wonderful. I can't tell you how happy I am to have you on the show. Tell me, you've been quite a long time an advocate of the use of medical marijuana.
Yes, for the past 10 years, I've been a huge advocate because I've been able to see with my own eyes the benefits and how it changes people's lives. So I am a huge advocate, yes.
Well, I tend to agree with you. Welcome. I mean, nothing's going to stop people anyway from using anything, but at the same time, I've seen some very positive effects come from the use of marijuana.
Absolutely. And just like with anything, there's always going to be a positive and a negative, just like alcohol or pills or anything like that. You know, some people have bad reactions to it, but for the most part, you know, people genetically like cannabis and it really works for them. And the most important thing we have to remember is that we have cannabinoid receptors in our brains, in our bodies, and marijuana is simply a cannabinoid. So our brains, we're supposed to be putting this in our body. This is a healthy thing for us.
Well, it is an organic material. It's not like some of these synthetic, horrible drugs that people take.
Yes, it is absolutely organic. It's very different. You know, I've had an argument with several people over the years, and they've said, oh, well, you know, what's the difference between marijuana and cocaine? Cocaine is a plant. And the answer to that is, well, first of all, in order to make cocaine, you have to process, you know, hundreds of thousands of pounds of the leaves, as opposed to just picking a little bud off of a plant like you would a tomato and eat it. And it's not something that's processed. So it's something that's really, really just from the earth. We don't have to process it to make it. All you have to do is hang it upside down and dry it like you would dry a flower, a rose, if you wanted to keep it. Now, cocaine is still used for dental work, and people use it in other countries. When
right.
you land in South America, they hand you coca leaves and tell you to chew it to help you with your altitude sickness. So, you know, there is medicinal use for everything, but should people be using cocaine? No, as a recreational drug, but alcohol is allowed, so I really don't understand why cannabis isn't.
Well, do you think then it's okay to use it as for recreational purposes rather than just medicinal?
Absolutely, and I think that if you look at the culture of people of really the whole world, people tend to self-medicate, and self-medicating is not a healthy thing. Whether you're self-medicating with cannabis or alcohol or pills, these are all unhealthy, you know, behaviors. But if you're just wanting to go out and have a drink for the night, personally, I can't drink because I'm really tiny, and it impairs me so much that when I drink, I'm completely drunk. And I would be able to, you know, handle myself in a situation if needed to be. However, if I were to smoke, you know, a couple hits of a joint, I'd be relaxed, I'd be euphoric, I'd be happy, I'd be in a good mood. People don't kill other people when they've been smoking a joint, when they're drinking. That's when
that you wouldn't be a danger to yourself or others, is what you're saying.
Absolutely, absolutely. I had a girlfriend that was a sorority sister of mine, and about 2 years ago, her husband on St. Patrick's Day went over to a friend's house, and they were both drinking, and the friend pulled out an antique rifle supposedly to show him, and we don't know what exactly happened, but he fired the gun, and he was drunk. He didn't realize it was a sensitive trigger. Next thing you know, my friend, who is 7 months pregnant with twins, is a widow.
Oh,
and, you know, she had a 3-year-old daughter. So these are the things that happen when people drink alcohol, and that's why I really don't like alcohol. I think most people can handle it, but a lot of people take things to an extreme.
Well,
and with marijuana, your extreme is maybe you'll take a nap or you'll eat something.
Well,
you'll get a little hungry.
Yeah, and personally, I mean, I think people are going to use it anyway. You're not going to stop them. But I'd like to see the profit motive taken out for these criminals. And if it were available
Absolutely.
Through
the
legitimate
lack of regulation
companies,
definitely
then,
creates
then
issues.
It would be inexpensive and the profit motive would be gone for these criminal activities. Frankly, I don't smoke anything, but if I were to use it, it would scare me to death to go out on the street and buy it on the street corner from some horrible person.
Right, exactly. And that's what, especially if you're sick, you wouldn't want to have to go risk going to jail if you're in the process of going through cancer treatments just to get a joint you don't throw up. That's not fair. That's not what our country was, you know, the freedom of our country was based on. you know, we should be able to have the freedom to walk into a dispensary or a store that is authorized and regulated to provide healthy cannabis that's been tested, that we know that it's a good product, that there's no mold spores, that there's no pesticides used, and be able to medicate. And if that makes it legal, so what? I mean, you can walk into a liquor store and pick your poison, as they say.
Well, I tend to agree with you.
You should be able to do that, you know.
Dr. Dina, tell me, you were the inspiration for that show, Weeds, is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because that's pretty interesting.
Well, at the time that I got into the industry, there were very few women around. And especially the women that were around were they had the long hair, very hippie girls, you know, covered in patchouli oil, hairy armpits, not very attractive.
I remember that.
And here I am.
I'm a little old. In 1965, I went to Haight-Ashbury for one day, and I never saw anything quite like it.
Right. So that's kind of the experience, you know, I saw when I first got into the industry. And I myself am not one of those girls, and I'm very much, you know, a Hollywood type. I hang out with a lot of celebrities, and I'm from L.A., and this is just the home that I grew up with. And so I'm not one of those girls, and people really took notice of that, is, wow, look at this girl. She doesn't fit the mold. And at the time that I started in the industry, I was working in a doctor's office, providing help to people getting medical marijuana recommendations written, because it's a Schedule I drug. Uh-huh. You can't write actual prescriptions for it. It has to only be a recommendation from a doctor, and that's the state of California.
I see.
So in the state of California, we write these recommendations, not me personally. I'm not a real doctor. I'm not board certified. Dr. Dina is simply a nickname that Snoop Dogg gave me.
Snoop Dogg gave you that name?
Yes,
that's
Snoop
very
Dogg.
Cool. How cool is that?
Yes, he's been a very close friend of mine for probably 20-something years. And, you know, when I first got into the industry, I know that he's one person that he definitely uses cannabis quite frequently. And the thought of him going to jail over something that to me seems like the equivalent of having a, you know, an ounce of weed is like having a bottle of whiskey. So, you know, I approached him and I talked to him, and he told me, yes, I have a few medical conditions, and those medical conditions were actually, he qualified him to get medical cannabis. So because I helped him acquire his first letter, he nicknamed me Dr. Dina, and we have a very loving relationship. In fact, I just got back from Colorado with him for the High Times Cannabis Cup. And it was really interesting because I've been in this world for 10 years, and in California, it's the air is very legal. You know, you feel comfortable going home and smoking a joint if you have a doctor's note. You're not worried about the police knocking your door down. They know you have rights.
Well, that's good.
And when you go to Denver, where it's been legalized and people are just smoking, and then you have people that are coming from Oklahoma and from all of Iowa and some states where they don't even have medical, and they're looking around going, oh, my gosh, aren't you worried the police are coming? And it was just, it reminds you that our work is not done. And that's really, because I'm such a huge activist, and because I know a lot of celebrities, and this is really something that's close to our heart, because if you look at the number of young African-American and Latino kids that are being thrown into prison, these private prisons that are making all this money off of them, because they had a little bit of pot or pot-related crime, really, you know, stick them in rehab, teach them the right way. Instead, we're throwing them in with burglars and rapists and murderers and teaching them the tricks of the trade, making criminals
sure.
out of them.
Well,
a felony, they can't get a job.
It seems to be more
so
widely
really,
accepted everywhere, and I see more and more states allowing it. Do you think the day will come where it will actually be allowed to be sold over the counter nationally? The federal government, do you think, will ever stop regulating it?
The biggest issue with marijuana is that marijuana cannot really be controlled. It's a plant. It's a plant that you can take a cutting off of someone else's plant, stick it into a cube, put it in your closet, and grow it, and they can't tax it. They can't control it. And that's the biggest issue. And that's why they fight it, because, of course, they want to make money off of it. And if you look at our world today, there's very few industries that are left to kind of create the people that are born today, like, what are their chances of creating an opportunity for themselves? Property is very expensive. Everything is very expensive. And how are they going to, you know, you think back in the day, you'd become a doctor and a lawyer, you make all this money. Well, nowadays, with Obamacare, nobody wants to be a doctor.
It's not so easy anymore.
Yeah. You know, and people who go into law school, you look, and most people who go to law school, they don't get jobs out of law school. So, you know, being able to create a whole other industry, you look and say, this country needs this right now. We need this boost of income. you know, this is not going to destroy our country. Not everybody is going to go run around smoking weed on the street. You control it, you make a law, and people will abide by it.
Well, I think
and
you're right.
I totally
agree with you, and
yeah.
I hope that we can help get this message out to people. Is there any website or anything that you would like to promote?
Well, at the moment, I'm doing some work with Be Real TV. Be Real is from Cypress Hill, so I'm going to be going in once a week and giving my little bit of cannabis knowledge. And I will be on Twitter as Dr. Dina, Instagram, Dr. Dina 420. And to answer your question about the weeds show, I was working on a project myself, a script, and some people came in and became friends with me, and I was very naive and gave my story, and next thing you know, they basically stole my story.
So they ripped you off.
They ripped me off. So
that's terrible. That's what happens in Hollywood.
That's it.
Well, thank you so very much for being on the show, and I think this was a really good interview, and I think everyone's going to enjoy hearing and learning it. I know I learned a lot myself.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day today.
You too. I'll talk to you soon.
Maya.
I love to eat. I don't understand people who forget to eat. It's my girlfriend. I forgot to eat. I'm so lightheaded. About 4 o'clock this morning, 8 of my friends and I, we split a Tic Tac. I don't know why, but I'm dizzy and disoriented. How can you forget to eat? I never stop thinking about eating. Even when I'm eating, I'm thinking about eating. Well, I'm having a sandwich now. It's about 2:30. Probably have a snack at about 2:32. I don't want to fill up and having dinner at 2:38 and a half. I don't mind buying. I hate sharing. Sharing's too cute for me. I'm getting a sandwich. You want one? No, thanks. I'll have a bite of yours. That wasn't the offer. But I don't want a whole sandwich. Don't have a whole sandwich, but have a bite of yours. What you do with it after your bite is your business. You can roll into a ball, knock a pelican out of here. I want a whole sandwich. How can you be so cheap? You don't like to share. No, I don't like to share. And by the way, I'm buying. How am I being cheap by buying? What the f*** kind of upside down logic is that? I met this woman from Arkansas. She says to me, "You ever have grits?" I go, "Yeah, I had grits." She goes, "You ever have fried okra?" I go, "Gee, I don't know if I've had fried okra." She goes, "I'll fry you up some okra so delicious, make you want to slap your mammy." Never heard that before. I can't imagine. I can't fathom anything so incredibly delicious that would make me want to just clock my mother. Man, this is good. I mean, this is really delicious. Mom, could you step over here for a second? I need to talk to you.
This is Jason Dadd. We're at the Tampa Side Splitters in Tampa, Florida, and I'm here with Dom Ayera, and he's going to be performing here Friday and Saturday night. Welcome down to the show.
Thank you, and thank you for dropping an R. It's Irera, but that's all right.
Gotta love my accent.
I got called Mr. Irene last week, and somebody else called me Mr. O'Hara. I don't know, they got O'Hara out of Irera. That's incredible.
Yeah, they're probably thinking about the airport in Chicago, right?
O'Hare.
O'Hare, yeah.
Yeah.
So tell me about your tour that you're on right now.
Well, I'm just away for a couple of weeks. I'm doing Side Splitters here in Tampa and then next week in Knoxville. And just bringing joy and good laughter to people who can't make themselves laugh, who have to pay for laughs.
Hey.
No, I'm kidding. I'm glad they do.
However you got to get it, right?
That's right.
So tell me a little bit about your career and how you got started into comedy.
Well, I was in plays at first. I was a 19-year-old rabbi and fiddler on the roof, Italian rabbi from South Philly, which is pretty funny. May God bless and keep us all far away from us. Forget about it. Hey, come on. I did a lot of plays. I did children's theater. Got my equity card, went up to New York, did some commercials, and then got into an improv group, and then just started doing stand-up because it was more lucrative than improv groups because you have to split the money six ways.
Now, how much harder is it to do improv than your typical comedy acts?
Well, it's harder to write a stand-up because you try and hone it and perfect it. That's the hard part. Like those little sets you see on Letterman and Leno, those sets are really hard to write. But improv to me is easier because you can just be funny like you are with your friends. Doesn't have to be like slick and tweaked and, you know, just refined. And like, I couldn't believe when I first started doing stand-up that people repeated themselves to get it better. I thought once you say something funny, you just throw it away and say something else funny. But it ain't, and it's not that easy. It's not that easy, see? Yeah. Yeah, you mug.
That's pretty good. I like that.
Thank you.
Do you like sometimes zero in on people in the crowd and just kind of like, you know, make them a part of the show?
Well, yeah, for different reasons. I mean, first of all, like, some people crave attention. That's why they sit in the front. And then sometimes they'll just seat like a lesbian couple or just, you know, a mixed race couple or just something that people will kid about, you know. But like one of the fun things for me is I work at the Laugh Factory. I'll be at the Laugh Factory in Chicago at the end of the month. And they'll seat these college girls up front. And I'll go, when would I ever get a chance to talk to you without you calling the bouncer and will you tell this guy to leave us alone? I don't want to drink from you. You know, like I'm talking to these 19, 20-year-old college girls, which is pretty funny. So it's an unusual situation in that sense.
What about the guy all the way in the back that you know is trying to avoid something?
Well, see, it's all according to the club because some, like if I do a theater or if I do a casino, you really can't see the people. When you're like at Side Splitters, you can see about 5 or 6 rows back, you know, which is a big difference because that's a lot of people to mess with, you know. So I prefer being able to see them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I prefer that to theaters and all.
What's been your biggest success to date?
I don't know. Probably being, it's hard to say, like winning the ACE Award, which is now an Emmy Award for the best stand-up special, and probably being voted from Comedy Central one of the top 100 comedians of all time. I love that all-time crap. You mean the Byzantine Empire and everything? The Romans and the Greeks? Wow. Didn't they have comedians? But I guess those two things, you know, to me, just the longevity of being around so long. And I love the fact that college kids come and see me. You know what I mean? Like I was working at a stress factory in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Beautiful Asian girl. She wanted me to sign something for her, I don't know, a headshot or something. And I said, how old are you? She goes, 19. I said, did you know who you were coming to see? She goes, yeah. She goes, hey, listen, man, funny's funny. And I thought, what a cool thing, you know?
Right.
I don't think of, like, you know, some beautiful little college girls. Let's go see Dom Irrera tonight instead of dancing, you know?
Well, that's cool. I mean, comedy really is timeless. I mean, it's not just,
yeah.
Anybody enjoys it.
Rodney
Everybody
Dangerfield
needs to
proved that, huh?
Absolutely. No respect.
Yeah, I'll tell you, you're all right, kid. You're all right. He was good to me, Rodney Dangerfield. He was the guy that gave me my real big break at the beginning of my career by putting me in his special in the late 80s. It was very cool because, you know, he was like such a legend. And then I meet him, and he leaves a message on my machine, which is so weird. I goes, oh, yeah, Dom, this is Rodney, you know, Dangerfield. Like I was going to confuse that voice or even the name Rodney with anybody else, you
right.
know.
So tell everybody where they can find you and some of the stuff coming up.
Well, my schedule is on domirrera.com always, and you can tweet me at domirrera, D-O-M-I-R-R-E-R-A. But you said Iera, which is hilarious because in the Dangerfield movie, oh, yeah, you said Iera, which in the last films Rodney Dangerfield ever made, he wrote a part for me, and he called it Iera. But I didn't get the part he wrote for me. I got another part. Because the guy who played the part that I was supposed to play was a better actor than me. So he got the part, which, you know, he deserved.
Very cool. And where can people see you coming up in the next couple weeks?
I'll be as I said, Knoxville. I'll be at the Laugh Factory in Long Beach. But most importantly, more recently, we will be Laugh Factory in Chicago. Columbus, Ohio, Funny Bone. The Stress Factory in New Brunswick, New Jersey. I'll be in Kilkenny, Ireland. If you happen to be in Kilkenny, stop by and see me at the Cat's Laugh Comedy Festival. I'll be in Australia for the Sydney. I'm just all over the world. Giving, giving, giving. What about me? What about my needs, huh, kid? Where else am I? I don't know. I don't think I left anything out. Denver Comedy Works. be there in March. You know, I love it. People always say, don't you get tired of traveling? I'm like, don't you get tired of staying home? You know? So I love it.
That's cool. And Kilkenny, is that where South Park got their inspiration from?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that joke beaten into the ground.
Right.
Who did you kill, Kenny? Nobody thought of that. You know, they would roll their eyes at that. I love South Park, but I mean, that's a really bad,
right,
redundant joke. You know?
Right. Hey, you got to throw some bad ones in there. That's what makes it, what makes it hilarious.
I take a couple. I take a couple just to show how good the good ones are.
Right. Well, thank you for coming on the show with us. And anybody that's here in the Tampa Bay area, you'll be able to see him this Friday and Saturday at the Tampa Side Splitters. And thank you for joining us.
Thank you. And come here because it's easy parking. We've got a great show. We got Maurice. What's his name? Maurice. Forget about the last name. Bobby Jules. Are you performing this week?
Yeah.
Oh, Bobby Jules on stage. The club owner is a terrific comedian. So, which is rare, you know. Usually they buy a club because they can't get on anywhere. He could get on anywhere. And yeah, come and see me because I don't know how long I'm going to last. Look at my face. This might be my last time here. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the show. Folks, I've got a really great guest online. We're speaking to Charles Faddis. Charles has quite a interesting and quite an amazing bio. He's a retired CIA officer and he's an author. He took the first CIA team into Iraq in 2002, and in 2008 he retired as the head of CIA's Weapon of Mass Destruction Terrorism Unit. That's quite a background. Charles, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you know, there's so many questions I'd like to ask you. I don't know if you can answer them or not, but when you went into Iraq, you know, we keep hearing that there were no weapons of mass destruction, yet I remember seeing all those trucks going into Syria. Do you think they moved them all?
I think that, on balance, that the assessment was wrong regarding the weapons of mass destruction. But it is, in other words, that the weapons that we went in to find were not there. But, you know, that whole situation is kind of complex in that Saddam's entire calculus was to get out from under the United Nations inspections. Okay. So that he could reconstitute those programs. In other words, he had never changed his mind about his ultimate goal of acquiring them.
You know, something that's troubling me today terribly much is it appears to me that this little love affair now that Obama's having with Rouhani in Iran is really throwing Israel under the bus.
Yeah, people have been asking me about the Syria situation, and I end up stuttering and stammering and saying I'm as lost as everybody else. On Iran, I'm probably even more lost because these guys, the Iranians, have been pursuing a nuclear weapon for many, many years, doing all sorts of things that have no application whatsoever to civilian nuclear power,
right,
and only are relevant to nuclear weapons. They haven't changed their minds. They haven't backed off, so I have no idea what it is we're talking to them about or what the basis for negotiation is.
I think they're, you know, this is a PR move, of course, and how would Israel look if they go in and attack them now with all of this love affair, as I say, that's going on with the White House and the Iranian government?
You know, here's what I find the most terrifying thing about the Iranian nuclear weapons program. What the Israelis have said for a long time, and I think on this they are 100% correct, is that what the Iranians are very close to having is effectively what they call a virtual bomb.
Uh-huh.
Which means that they're so close to having all the components, they will not have an assembled device, but they will be capable of going from not having a device to having a device so quickly that you will not be able to stop them, that they are inching to the line. It's effectively like a guy who's sitting in front of you with all the pieces of a firearm,
right,
taken apart on the table and saying to you, what gun?
Well, you know,
and
the one thing, very close to where we are. The one thing I think that will happen, though, is that no matter what happens over there, if it's necessary and it has to be done, Israel will do it.
You know, the Israelis are tough guys. I've worked with them a lot. When they, you know, if it comes up against it and they're forced to go alone, they'll go alone. You know, part of the problem is that as good as the Israelis are, they do not have the capabilities that we have. And so even with all the will in the world, They do not necessarily have the Air Force and the munitions necessary to really take out this program. They'll try. They may just not be able to do it. It may be a bridge too far for them.
Well, they do have atom bombs.
They do have atom. If they choose to use the atom bombs, that might change the calculus. But when I say the capabilities, I mean, for instance, there are basic things like mid-air refueling.
Right.
That they don't really have the capacity, because they don't typically look at launching air raids thousands and thousands of miles from Tel Aviv. That just sort of puts them in a bind. I mean, there are ways around that, but you're sort of band-aiding together solutions. So clearly, if somebody's going to hit the place and effectively take out the program, that needs to be an American strike.
Well, it's pretty frightening, and to me it looks exactly like 1938, and we have Neville Chamberlain sitting in the White House.
Well, the Iranians having a bomb is a nightmare on so many levels, it's really hard to know where to begin. I mean, these guys themselves, as a nation state, are dangerous. They are in league with people like Hezbollah. And then there's the fact that, in addition to the Israelis, there are a lot of other countries in the Middle East that are scared as hell of them.
Oh, I think the Saudis are terrified of them.
The Saudi, absolutely. So that hits at the Arab-Iranian division, the Shia-Sunni division.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things the Saudis are going to do if we let the Iranians get a bomb is they are almost certainly going to develop their own nuclear weapons to counter them. And then we're going to go from there. So there are all sorts of ripple effects that we're going to feel.
Scary as hell. Tell us about the book that you've written, Charles. I know you've written more, many books, but tell us about what your really book that you have out now.
Well, the latest book that I've come out with is a novel called Kaffa, C-A-F-F-A, which is the third novel in the series, and it's about a fictional biological weapons attack on the United States.
Wow.
And it's centered around the same two principal characters as the previous two novels, a former CIA officer named Bill Boyle and a former Greek terrorist, actually, named Eleni Paraskevi. And I do in this book what I try to do in all the fiction that I write, which is, A, make it entertaining and a fast read and something that doesn't feel like a textbook, and B, something that actually will teach people a little bit about what it's really like running intelligence operations and counter-terrorist operations.
Fictional, but something that could happen in the realm of possibility.
I remember that when Jim Webb was asked about writing his famous book about Vietnam, they asked him why he wrote a fiction book and not nonfiction, and he said, sometimes you can tell more truth with fiction. And that's kind of the approach that I take. By fictionalizing some things, you can discuss some subjects that would be impossible to talk about if you put them in a nonfiction context. I mean, the threat of biological attack is unfortunately very, very real. Every WMD expert I know counts that as the number one terrorist mass casualty threat to the country is a bioweapons attack.
And there's no vaccine for so many of these things. There's just nothing you can do.
There's no vaccine, and even if you have a vaccine, if the epidemic gets going, there's no warehouse with a stockpile of a dose for every man, woman, and child, in the United States. Very rapidly, even diseases that are treatable can outrun the available stockpiles of medication.
Oh, that's scary. Charles, can you tell us how folks can get hold of your book and how they can read it? Because it sounds totally fascinating.
Right. Easiest way is just to go on to Amazon.com. It's available both as paperback and as Kindle. Title, again, is Kaffa, C-A-F-F-A, which is a historical reference, which is the name of a town that's explained in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I also have a website, the United States of Common Sense, because I do a lot of op-ed type writing.
It's kind of an oxymoron, isn't it?
You know what? I got to tell you, as frustrated as I am with things like the political system, I retain a lot of faith in the American people.
Well, so do I.
If we could get the politicians out of the way, I think we'd be okay.
We need the people with the pickup trucks, the guns of the rack across the back.
I'm with you. We need average Americans, because the average Americans have common sense, which seems to somehow, when you drive inside the Beltway in Washington, D.C., it begins to vaporize somehow.
I think so. You're right about that.
By the time you get to the hill, you cannot think straight. Up is down, right is left. It's crazy.
Well, Charles, again, tell us once more your website, because I interrupted you, which wasn't very nice.
So my website is the United States of Common Sense, all is one word, .com. Go there. I mean, I've got other pages and comment in a variety of places, but the United States of Common Sense will link you to everything that I'm doing online, and it'll get you to the books. It'll get you everywhere.
Fascinating. And Charles, again, we have Charles Faddis we've been speaking to. Go to the United States of Common Sense, and I think you really owe it to yourself to read this book, Kaffa. I hope it's not a precursor of things to come.
You know, I hope not, too.
Charles, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Even if Fred was a little special. Fred was kind with good intent, but just a little different. Oh, special Fred. Mama dropped him on his head. Now he's not so bright instead. He's a little bit special.
Welcome back to the show. I'm delighted to have our weekly segment with Fred Claridge, our stock market moron. Fred, welcome to the show.
Wait a second. I'm still trying to get an arrow out of my... Okay, I'm here.
How did you do this week?
Well, thank goodness there is a God, and the market was closed yesterday, so I broke even. which, in general days, that's pretty darn good. I hope everybody out there listened to me and stayed away from Lululemon, because that's still dropping down. But I'm telling you, folks, in my opinion, if that gets to around in the low 40s, it's something to look at. By that, I mean go out and buy yourself a Lululemon outfit, and especially all of you pedophiles, because you can see through it.
So that's spandex yoga clothes, and that's what you invested in.
Absolutely, and it was a stretch, but I did it.
How much have you lost on that so far?
Oh, well, let's see. On 300 shares and 10 points, let me see. You know, that goes up to, it goes $1,000 more than I have fingers and toes. So I guess that's $3,000.
Well, that's but, not know, too as, bad as, for you in 1 week. I mean, you lost $1 million in one day. Do you have any new tips for anyone this week that people would want to look at?
Yes, this week, I understand I didn't see it yet because I was out this morning, but it looked like the market was going to be up 100 points. And one of my fans or fannies called and let me know that the market was down. So I would suggest that if you live in the big city, walk close to tall buildings. There's a saying on Wall Street that as January goes, so goes the year. And if it's true so far, we got a lot of what they call in Italian soros.
There's a lot of trouble in store for this year. Well, Have you bought anything today?
No. I just want to remind you about one of my favorite stocks, and that's the Heine Brothers Winery. And their board of directors is fantastic. You have the three brothers, Big, Red, and Thor. So don't forget, get your Heine Brothers Winery stock. Look it up, Google it, and I'm telling you, you will feel like you've lit up, as the president would say.
Well, Fred, thank you again for some sage advice. And I hope everyone will do just the opposite of what Fred tells you to do, and you're going to make a lot of money. Thanks, Fred, for coming on the show.
It's always a pleasure, Stuart.
Talk to you again next week.
I will be wet myself.
Aren't you ashamed?
That's all, folks.